listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today we have another double feature for you guys and gals and nine binary pals.
I love that phrase.
Yes, guys, gals, nine binary pals. We got a double feature because it is Looney Labs Tember.
Not really. It's well,
we could do themed months on this podcast too.
Sure, we have in the past. Just
yeah, we have.
I don't know if we're really going to do a whole Tember out of it.
Okay,
we've barely done any Tember.
Well, today we are talking about two games from the publisher Looney Labs. So, Matthew, what games are we talking about today?
We are talking about Flux and Chrononauts. Both of them designed by Andrew Looney, and Flux was also designed by Kristen Looney, and both of them published by Looney Labs in 1997 and 2000, respectively.
Right. So the way we're going to structure this episode is we're going to spend the first part of the episode talking about Flux, and we'll spend the second part of the episode talking about Chrononauts, and then at the end we might do a little comparison discussion.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so first off is Flux. So for a short description of what Flux is about, in Flux, players draw one card, then play one card until one player wins. The rules, however, are constantly in flux.
Hmm.
Get it? Including how many cards you draw, how many you play, and how you win. The first player to achieve victory based on the active goal card wins. So that's it. It's a pretty simple game. There's just a deck of cards. Everybody draws a hand of cards from the deck. I think it's like two or three cards. Probably three at the start of the game. And the beginning rules, the basic rules, are draw one, play one. And the game starts out with no method of achieving victory. Except maybe there's like a, there might be a clause for like obtaining a number of keepers, like having just a bunch of keepers might win the game for you. Anyways, so you draw one card, play one card. The types of cards that you play, there are keepers, which are sort of these permanent cards that stay in front of you on the table. There are rule cards, which can change how many cards you draw per turn, how many you play, what the maximum hand size is. There's the goal cards, which list a number of keepers that you have to have control of in order to win at the end of the round, or at the end of your turn. And then there's some action cards that will be used to exchange keepers, mess with the rules, take unique sorts of actions on your turn, or in some cases there's some like gacha cards that you can use to counter certain other players' actions. And that's basically it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a pretty simple game. You just draw cards, you play cards. When you play a rule, it immediately takes effect. If it's a draw card rule and you haven't drawn that many cards per turn, you draw the difference based on what you have drawn. So like say if at the start of your turn the rule was draw two, and so you drew two, but then you play a draw three rule, you immediately get to draw a card just so that you have drawn three cards for that turn. If you play a goal, it will immediately take the place of any previously active goal, so there can only be one goal at a time unless the dual goals rule is played. It's like sort of a bonus rule. So there can sometimes be two goals active. If you play keeper, it just sticks in front of you. Some keepers have abilities that you can utilize on your turn. Other keepers, they just sit in front of you, and they're just required for different victories. And then, yeah, the actions, when you use them, they get put into a discard pile.
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much it.
Yeah. Let's talk strategy.
Is there
a strategy? I would say there's one main point of strategy with Flux, and that's just that your keepers are safer on the board and your goals are safer in your hand.
Yeah.
So when it comes to deciding which card you play per turn, it's best to play your keepers early and then save your goals, keep them in your hand, keep them a secret, because as soon as you play a goal, if you don't win the game that turn, any other player can play another goal and just erase it from the board. Maybe the only situation where you might want to play a goal is if multiple players have the keepers listed on the goal, so they are incentivized to keep it on the board. And then you steal one of their, maybe you have an action in your hand that allows you to steal a keeper away from somebody to achieve the victory the next turn.
Yeah. Also, even if you don't need a keeper for a goal, like, it's still probably worth playing if you don't have anything else to play that turn.
Yeah. And it's not really a strategy, but personally, I just like to get all of the most ridiculous rules out there as soon as possible, just to, like, ramp up the action and chaos in the game. I enjoy Flux when it's going, like, mad, as opposed to when it's sort of crawling, like, zero max hand size, draw one, play one. Not a fan of that.
You don't like the stacks Flux.
No.
Max Flux instead is what you want.
Mm-hmm. I like Max with two X's.
Yeah, of course.
One thing we can talk about before we get into the design is that there are a number of reskins for Flux. Looney Labs Games have published a number of versions of Flux, some of them with various like licensed IP, like Star Trek Flux, Star Wars Flux, regular show Flux. You know, if you think of it, there's probably a Flux for it. Wizard of Oz Flux, Monty Python Flux. So, first of all, there's sometimes differences between the games in their mechanics and rules. I think, for example, my favorite version of Flux is Cthulhu Flux, which includes sort of these anti-keepers in the form of the old gods, the eldritch deities from Cthulhu mythos, which are sort of like keepers, but you have to play them if they're in your hand, and they prevent you from winning the game. And if too many of them get played out on the board, then everybody loses. And then the other mechanic is that, so there's that, which is coupled with the everybody loses mechanic. And then there's a method of victory in the game where you actually win if everybody loses.
But that's only in Cthulhu Flux.
That's only in Cthulhu Flux. I have a copy of Zombie Flux as well, which has, I think, a similar mechanic where there's some of the keepers are zombies, and if too many zombies are out on the field, then everybody loses.
Yeah. So there's some differences between the different versions. Mm-hmm. For the most part, you're kind of getting Flux with the iconography of whatever series or franchise or aesthetic that you choose.
Yeah, just switch the keepers out with anything from that franchise, like phasers from, you know, this thing, or superheroes from that thing, you know.
Yeah. I don't have much in the way of strategy, but I do want to mention that playing rules cards doesn't get you as good of a bonus immediately as it will on all subsequent turns. Because if you were to play like a draw three rules card, then you draw two more cards, but the card that you played would have been one of the cards you'd drawn before, and everybody else gets to draw three new cards from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, if you play a like play two card, then you get to play one extra card, but everybody else will play two cards.
Yeah, you sort of only played one card since the first card didn't really do anything for you.
Yeah, so keep in mind that any rules card you play that is in an increase of what is already out there, your opponents will get more from it than you, kind of in general.
Mm-hmm.
But if you play something that decreases what's out there, then you can get more than your opponents.
Yeah, like if you change the play three down to a play one or a play two, you know, that can be the third card you play on your turn.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on the design of the game going into it?
Yes, I do.
It feels a little interesting getting into design discussion so soon, but
yeah.
All right. Yes. I know you have strong opinions about this game.
Yeah. So I've kind of realized I'm not the biggest fan of this style of party game where like it plays like a game where obviously you make decisions, but ultimately whether you win is super like draw dependent, and it's kind of set up in a way that a player will win in kind of the same amount of time if everybody is playing, you know, optimally, I guess. But it doesn't necessarily reward skill as much as it is just like, hey, somebody won, cool. Which is very like Mario Kart in a way, in that like, it's fine for people who don't really care about, you know, breakneck competition and then winning by like the sweat of your brow or whatever. If you just want like a casual game that you can easily explain to people, it's fine. But I'm not super into that. I will say, though, quick setup and breakdown means it's easy to play multiple games. So if you feel like somebody won surprisingly, you can always just play another game of it or another hand of it. Also, the fact that the rules are on the cards is another sort of way this is incredibly accessible.
Yeah, this is a classic example of just like having the rules on the game pieces themselves makes the game very easy to pick up and play.
Yeah, obviously, like the rules are part of the game. They're malleable. But even then, it's kind of like nowadays, a lot of games will have helper cards that the player keeps next to them that they can like cross-reference as they play. This kind of just includes that as part of the game. I think the thing about Flux is that it's so easy to teach to people because, like, draw one, play rules cards, the rules cards say what they do. Keepers don't really have a whole lot to them by themselves, except for goals, which goals tell you to win. Like, everything is very self-apparent, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I guess there is sort of a lacking piece of rules text on the keepers that is just to say, like, when you play them, they stay in front of you.
Yeah, but you do keep them.
But yeah, you do keep them. I guess it's there in the name, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this game, it has an admirable simplicity to it and an admirable straightforwardness to it that, you know, a lot of games could benefit from having such straightforward presentation rules and mechanics and pieces. But I think when it comes to like base Flux, it's just like, personally, I feel it's so like dry and it doesn't really excite me in a way that many games do. You know, potentially it's that the theming of original Flux is just, it really doesn't have a theme. Like the keepers are things, but I don't know if there's really anything that connects them together thematically. Right.
They're kind of like vague topics.
Yeah.
Like, isn't just like money one of them or something like that? Peace?
Yeah, but then having said that, it's definitely not just the flavor that makes me not want to come back to this game, because there's plenty of other versions that have flavor. You know, there's, I guess my favorite version, you know, Cthulhu Flux has some extra layers of flavor to it. In addition to the theming, you know, it has mechanical things that add to the flavor and theme of the game. But I think I would go back and play that. I think I am a little excited. Maybe that's just sort of a nostalgia, because I played that so long ago, and it's been a while since I've played Cthulhu Flux. But yeah, it's something about the flavor mixed with the gameplay. Maybe it's just that, like, because the game is so easy to re-theme, then that just goes to show that the theme doesn't really combine with the mechanics. The mechanics are just like this really dry, open, like templatable kind of thing that can just copy and paste to any other thing. And maybe like that comes just as a result of it being a mechanic that I'm not really interested in interacting with and like exploring.
I don't know what it is about the graphic design, but like the way it manages like its headers and its like typefaces and everything feels very like clinical, or like a textbook, or like a poster you would see at a doctor's office telling you to wash your hands. Like,
okay, now I gotta look at, well, the illustrations look kind of like clip art.
Yeah.
At least in the original game, they may well be clip art. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's pretty. Yeah, I mean, it is pretty plain. The typeface, I think, is it's not Futura, which is what I immediately associate with math textbooks.
Sure.
But it looks like it might be Gil Sans, which is also a pretty common. It looks a lot like Gil Sans, which is a pretty sterile typeface, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I think the textbook comes from like white background, like pretty stark white background. You know, this little like section or this like color like frame and bar on the left side for the cards reminds me of like when you flip to a chapter in like a science textbook, it says what the chapter is on the left side.
Exactly.
You know? It's like a little tab. And then the black type on white background with these clip art pictures just like interspersed throughout the text.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly like a textbook. I mean, I guess they have good hierarchy, you know, the way that they use their type. You know, keeper is really big at the top, then they have some copy, and then they have the name of the card in a couple different places. And then when it comes to like an action, yeah, it's like big bold at the top, and then they have some lines. But the way that they manage like headline, subhead, body copy, dope, like very similar hierarchy that you would use when you were like designing a textbook.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like Flux is a game where it doesn't really match up to a lot of other games in the same genre in one way or another, but it's also from 1997, so like I kind of don't blame it. Mm-hmm. It feels like a game that's been outclassed by time because that's how creativity works.
Sure.
I do also want to say that I think the idea of playing a victory condition card is sort of a promise that it doesn't keep. Like, when I think of Flux, I don't think of playing the goal cards as changing the condition to win. It feels like, yeah, you're creating a method to win, but it doesn't feel as drastic as, like, if you were to change a way to win in chess, you know, mm-hmm. you would be like, instead of checkmating the king, it's kill all the pawns, for example. Like, maybe not even that drastic, but just all the victory cards tend to work in sort of the same way. And so it doesn't feel as much like changing a rule as it is just portraying the rule with two new keepers.
It's kind of almost like, you're not changing the rule to win. Like, that's just the last card you have to play to win.
Yeah.
The rule to win the game stays the same throughout, which is just that, like, have the correct combination of keepers and goals.
Exactly.
On the table.
If there was a rule that was, like, have this many cards in hand, or, you know, play a new rule card and a keeper in the same turn, mm-hmm. like, I could see those being a bit more interesting to me as, like, fulfillment of the idea of creating a new win condition.
Sure.
But as it stands, they all kind of blend together.
By the way, I looked up Cthulhu Flux, and the Eldritch deities, they're called creepers as opposed to keepers. And there are ungoals, which is the way that you win via losing.
I think the zombies are also creepers.
Yeah, I think that would make sense.
Which makes me wonder if there's a Minecraft Flux. Probably.
There probably is. There was... When Flux was coming out with new versions left and right, I believe Minecraft was... I mean, Minecraft's still in its heyday.
Oh, yeah.
That's not... Don't get us wrong about Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
anyways, let's see. Is there anything else to say about Flux?
Not really. Everything else I have to say comes in the comparison section.
Okay. I think I just want to add right at the end, like, that I guess when it comes to games... When it comes to gateway games... I think Flux could appeal to a certain kind of crowd and, you know, bring them or inspire them to play slightly more complicated games than they might be familiar with, specifically just like the playing card, you know, crowd. And anybody who's into games that involve playing cards, Flux is a nice step towards something a little more complex. And it's very easy, again, to teach someone how to play because, again, everything's on the card.
I don't know if I would call Flux a gateway game in the sense that it doesn't feel like something that really transitions to more complicated games.
Maybe, let me put it,
breaks people's perceptions that they might enjoy something.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's not necessarily a gateway game in the sense that it leads to other games, but it's sort of like, it's a game that, I think it's the game that if somebody's critique of board gaming as a whole is just that the rules are too complicated. This could be a game to show them, like, you know, the rules can still be complicated, but maybe the rules aren't as complicated as you imagined, or the rules can be complicated, but it still can be a fun game despite that, because this game's all about complicating the rules.
Yeah.
And it achieves, you know, an easy presentation of that idea by just having all the rules very clearly written on the cards and... starting simple and becoming more complex as the game goes on.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a quick break then, and when we come back after the break, we will discuss Chrononauts. All right, so if you'd like, you can follow us on Twitter at BG Bros Cast, where we tweet out when our episodes go live. You can interact with us there, hit us up with suggestions for topics, or just your comments in general. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged. If you're looking for our thoughts on a specific game, you can use our search function there to find that episode and listen to it. And again, if you don't see what you're looking for, you can hit us up with a suggestion. I think on our About Us page, we also have a little email field. You could shoot us an email if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, etc. Use that method to reach out to us. We've also got a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, where we have merch with our cool logo and branding all over it.
Yeah.
So that's it for BG Bros plugs. Let's hear it from App Plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time nowadays. I stream competitive games like fighting games or strategy games. I stream roguelites a lot. I stream some puzzle games. Every Friday, I do a thing called 47 Friday, where I play Hitman and people can use channel points to mess with me. And recently I've been playing through Deathloop, which has been a really interesting game. Really, really fun game, but also interesting, but also fun. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at MattCraigGaming, where I tweet out what I'm thinking about, what I've been playing, what I'm working on. General opinions, as it were. Not many hot takes, but definitely some maybe warmer than room temperature takes. You can also check out my mashup album at photonpunch.bandcamp.com. That's photonpunch.bandcamp.com. For the album Hard Punch Light Kick, a 12-song mashup album that mixes some popular songs, some internet jokes. If you like things like Neil Cicierega and his mashup albums, or stuff like Galactic Hole, then you'll probably like this. Check it out. Mm-hmm. Also, you can check out my other podcast, NetSurfer Pro, at Whirlwind Ride Through the World Wide Web. I messed that up somehow.
You slipped a little there.
Yeah, where practice. Me and my friend Galen talk about different media from the last 20-ish years. In October, we are covering spooky video game-related things. So if that sounds interesting to you, then check that out. NetSurfer Pro on all major podcasting platforms, and at NetSurfer Pro on Twitter.
Are you going to be mentioning how every copy of Super Mario 64 is personalized?
Actually, yes.
Nice, because it's true.
It is true, yeah. Mine has my name written on it.
That's weird. They knew you were going to buy it. All right. Yeah, and if you'd like, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs. I mean, speaking of typefaces, I have the word designs in my name because that's what I do for money.
It's a living.
All right. That's it for plugs. Let's go back to our episode where we will discuss Chrononauts. And we're back. Okay, so we spent the first part of the episode talking about Looney Labs' game Flux. Now let's talk about their game Chrononauts.
Yes, which once again was designed by Andrew Looney and published in 2000.
Yes. All right, so for a short description on what Chrononauts is about, in Chrononauts, players are time travelers from alternate timelines attempting to change and patch history while collecting rare historical artifacts. On your turn, draw one card, then play one card. The first player to either collect the artifacts listed on their secret mission or patch the timeline so they can return home is the winner. Okay, so I think I want to start real quick by just mentioning that this game, just to address it, is like very like American-centric in its history, very Euro-centric in its history, and the things that it focuses on. So whereas like parts of it are like world history, it's just most of it is world history that's relevant to like American people.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that out of the way. This game is, again, a draw one, play one game. So similar to Flux, in this game, the rule doesn't change. It's always going to be draw one, play one. However, there is a slight caveat where because it's similar to Flux, it's about like assembling very specific cards from a deck, and there's no way to draw extra cards every turn as a rule. Instead, there's a bonus rule that instead of playing a card, you can discard a card. And you have the option to discard a second card at the end of your turn if you chose to discard a card. And if you do so, then you may draw an extra card. So it's a way of going through the deck a little faster.
Yeah, normally that means that you end up with the same amount of cards in your hand at the end of your turn as you started with. Normally. Yes.
Normally. There are a couple of ways of winning this game. I mentioned that there's this timeline, which in the basic version of the game has, 32 different timeline events spanning from 1865, which is Lincoln assassinated, all the way to 1999, which is the Columbine High School massacre. There's some pretty heavy topics in this game.
Also, again, it's literally Americentric because it starts with the Lincoln assassination.
Yeah, yeah, that's where the game believes.
It starts after America was founded.
Right. Okay, so the cards on the timeline come in two different varieties. The first variety is a linchpin, which is essentially an event on the timeline that has two different outcomes. And by changing the outcome, a number of the other timeline events can be turned into paradoxes. So, like, for example, Lincoln assassinated is a linchpin. If that outcome is reversed and Lincoln survives assassination, then Andrew Johnson impeached can never happen because Andrew Johnson never becomes president. So that's the very next timeline event. It's 1868, Andrew Johnson impeached. If Lincoln is saved from assassination, then 1868 becomes a time paradox. You flip the card over, and it has paradox on the other side. So there's linchpins, and there's, I guess, not linchpins, or holes that eventually may need to be filled.
Yes.
So
you fill
these 32.
Holes.
So there's 32 cards. Yeah. Yes, you fill those holes with one of the types of cards that's in the deck. So there's the deck of cards. There's the cards that make up the timeline. And then there are missions and
identities.
And we'll get to missions and identities later. But let's talk about the deck of cards, yes. So one of the types of cards in the deck are these patches, is what they're called. They're an orange card, and they are played over paradoxes to fix the timeline so that things can continue to run smoothly. Every paradox, or every card in the timeline that becomes a paradox based on its linchpins, has one patch in the deck that corresponds to it. Except for 1945, which I believe has three different patches.
Yeah.
So yeah, so there's patches in the deck. There are artifacts, which are sort of like keepers in this game, where they're things that you play and they stay in front of you and they can shuffle around. There are the fate reversal cards. What are they called? Inverters. There are yellow cards that flip the linchpins, and each inverter works slightly differently to the other ones. There are gadgets, which are sort of like artifacts that stay in front of you, but they have things that you can do every turn with them. They have like active abilities. And then there are actions, which are similar to the actions in Flux, where you play them, you do a thing, and then you put it in the discard pile. And then there are time warps, which are just like super actions that do more than what an action would do.
Yeah.
And actions and time warps can, you know, trade hands, shuffle the artifacts around. They can play cards from the discard pile or search out cards from the deck and add them to your hand. Those are the kinds of things you do with actions and time warp. Everyone starts with three cards in their hand, and then again the rule is draw one, play one. And if you ever play a patch over a paradox, you get to draw a bonus card.
Yes, that ends up increasing your hand size, and it's the only way to do so.
Yeah, and that's you one card. And one of the ways of winning this game is by having 10 cards in your hand. So that means you basically have to make 7 patches and keep the cards in your hand, because there's ways of your cards being given to another player.
Yeah.
With different actions.
Yeah.
Okay. So Chrononauts strategy. Let's talk about missions and ID, because this is how you win.
So pretty much every mission requires 3 specific artifacts to be played in front of you.
In some cases, 4.
4. Okay. In some cases, they can also be a category of artifact. Like, there's one that requires a dinosaur skeleton, or no, a live dinosaur, not a skeleton, a real dinosaur, but it can be like a T-Rex or a Stegosaurus.
Yes. There's also 3 different Mona Lisas, 2 of which are forgeries. One of those forgeries is an obvious fake. The other is convincing.
Yeah.
And there's the real Mona Lisa itself.
Yeah.
And so some missions will have you like get one of the Mona Lisas or all three of the Mona Lisas. Sometimes you just need to have the most convincing Mona Lisa on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, and artifacts for the most part don't have any bonus effects. Sometimes they do. Like, for example, I think it was the Sports Almanac or potentially... No. It was the Beatles, like, reunion tour album, which is it's an artifact you can only play if John Lennon survives the assassination, which is one of the linchpins on the... Or actually, it might be one of the timeline events. Not a linchpin. It is a linchpin. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's one of the linchpins. So if the linchpin is flipped over, then you can...
play the Beatles reunion CD.
You can, yeah, and the Beatles reunion CD can then take the place of any other artifact that you might need for your mission.
Very powerful. So
that's your mission. You're trying to obtain a certain number of artifacts. It works similarly to the goals in Flux, except it doesn't change. I think there might be a time warp card that lets you change your mission, but for the most part, you just keep the mission that you have at the beginning of the game.
Yeah.
Unlike the goals in Flux. And then the ID, on your ID, you will have three timeline events. Typically, two of them are patches, and one of them is a event that has to happen as it happened in our timeline.
Yes.
So you win via your ID when the timeline has the listed events on your ID, which is sort of like to say, like, because these events happened, you are now in your character's timeline, and you can go back home.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the three ways of winning, either having your mission, having your ID, or having 10 cards in hand. There is a thing in this game that can cause everyone to lose, and that is that if there are ever 13 unpatched paradoxes in the timeline.
Yeah, so, then like time unravels.
Yes, and there's also a way to prevent people from winning in some cases. Sort of as a result of performing a specific series of actions. But if 1945 gets flipped, which it can only be flipped if three different linchpins are reversed in the timeline. So if all three of the linchpins relative to or related to 1945 are flipped, 1945 becomes a paradox. And one of the patches for 1945 is World War III, which is the end of the world and the end of the timeline. So if World War III is ever placed as a patch for the 1945 paradox, then all other timeline events after 1945 are removed from the game. And this can prevent people with, like, IDs that require events after 1945 to happen. It can stop them from winning the game via their ID. It can also stop people from playing artifacts from after 1945, because that's another part... another rule of the 1945 World War III that you can no longer play artifacts that exist or that are obtained from time periods after 1945.
There is one very confusing edge case regarding that.
Yes.
Which is tomorrow's newspaper.
Yeah. Suppose you'll have to house rule that.
Yeah. However, think it's after 1945, so I think it will be considered post-World War III in that case.
I would like to point out that there is one ID in the game who is a sentient cockroach from the end of the world. Because, of course, like after, you know, nuclear apocalypse, all the cockroaches will survive. So that in that case, that character specifically wins if World War III occurs.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk more about Chrononauts. We could talk strategy. Do you have any strategy points for this game?
Yeah, so I think going for your mission is generally easier than going for your identity. This is because just based on cards alone, your identity requires four cards to be played, which are two inverters, two patches, and then it also requires somebody else not playing a inverter for your, like, you know, kind of standard timeline event.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, it should be mentioned, so an inverter can be used in some cases to flip a event that happened in our timeline to the alternate outcome, such as Lincoln surviving his assassination. But in other cases, it can also be used to reverse a reversed outcome to return it back to normal. And in that case, whenever a linchpin is flipped back to its original state, any of the paradoxes that linchpin was responsible for causing are also returned to their original state. And if there were any patches on those paradoxes, they are discarded.
Yeah. That's the other thing, is that even if you play the patch that you need for your identity, it could just be discarded because somebody else needs that face up, or they need that linchpin face up. Whereas artifacts are the hardest to interact with. There are some actions that like steal artifacts from other players or make them discard them. But in general, playing an artifact is much safer than playing a patch, as far as like completing one of your objectives is. Now, that being said, playing patches to draw cards is generally still pretty useful, because it means you have more cards in hand. Maybe whatever card you draw, you'll need later. And it's possible to, like, you know, just by default end up with 10 cards in hand. That being said, there is the action that, like, passes hands around. So it's also really hard to go for playing patches in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the existence of the card that passes hands around is really interesting in this game. I guess I'll talk more about it when we get to the design discussion. But it's kind of weird that like that exists. It can undo so much in this game and like really throw a wrench in multiple people's strategies.
Yeah, but if you have artifacts in play, those don't get passed.
True. I guess maybe the only thing is that like people could maybe be hiding artifacts in their hand, you know, just like sitting on different artifacts in their hand that maybe they don't need for victory, but other people might, so they don't want to play them, they just want to keep them. And I guess it's harder to steal a card from someone's hand versus get it out of the discard pile. There's a couple different cards that return cards from the discard pile to your hand.
Sure.
So I suppose the hand passing card might be some way of discouraging that.
So I wanted to say that I do think playing artifacts you don't need, even if other people need them, is beneficial.
Yeah.
I think one of the benefits is that at least one other player won't know what your goal is. So your mission and your identity are hidden from everybody else.
Yes.
If you play the game enough, you'll probably catch on like, oh, there's the cockroach who wants to end the world. Or there's the hippie who wants marijuana legalized. Or there's the mission that wants the news and everything. Or there's the mission that wants a live dinosaur for like cloning purposes. You know, what have you. And so if you play artifacts you don't need, it might confuse somebody. They might think you have a mission that you don't have, and then they'll like attack you in some way, making you discard a card you don't need.
Yeah, there are ways of like stealing other people's artifacts. So yeah, maybe playing other artifacts could just be red herrings, and other people might steal those instead of your own. Although usually people play steal an artifact cards when somebody has an artifact they need for their victory condition. Yeah.
The other thing is that I'm pretty sure there are more cards that dig from the discard pile than there are steal from another player.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. But it felt like when we were playing that they were more frequent. And if that's the case, then it's better to play the artifact than discard it from your hand if you, like, don't know what else to play.
For sure. Not to mention, there's also a number of cards that if you have to discard an artifact to use the card, or discarding an artifact maybe improves the ability of the card. So having just a couple spare artifacts, since you can only play one card per turn, you know, you can't, like, play the artifact and then immediately discard it to another card. Unless you played a time warp that lets you play two cards. But anyways, yeah, if you do that, if you play your artifact on one turn, then on a future turn, you might be able to discard it for great effect.
Yeah.
I will point out, when we played two games, and the first game, the player that won from the timeline being set a specific way. And the second game was victory via mission. So we have seen them both. I feel like you said, the missions are a little bit safer to achieve, but similar to Flux, you know, if the draw is good and the other players play the right cards, you might just happen to stumble into you might just chance upon an opportunity to win via your ID, which is the timeline victory.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Chrononauts design, and then let's finish on a comparison discussion.
Mm-hmm. One thing is that I think this game is funnier than Flux.
Yes.
I think the writing in this is generally better. Heavy political topics aside, or heavy, like, historical topics.
Sure.
I think the artifacts are very funny and add a lot of, like, lightheartedness to what could be a very serious or morbid game.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Mona Lisas, the whole joke is that there's one real one, there's a bunch of forgeries, but if the real one isn't out, then you can convince people that the forgery is real, thus using it like the real Mona Lisa.
Right.
I think that's a great joke, that there's all these Mona Lisas that are, you know, just slightly off.
You know, it's there's not a lot of mechanical jokes in board gaming. So I think that's actually pretty commendable, that, like, the mechanic is the joke in this game.
I do also think the cockroach who wants to create World War III is very funny. It's almost like a selling point of the game. Like,
yes.
You can describe the game to somebody and be like, oh, well, you could create World War III, which normally is bad, but there is a cockroach who wants you to do that. Like, that's kind of a fun selling point. But it's also just like, it utilizes the mechanics in a pretty clever way to create, like, a character that is unique to this setting.
For sure. Yeah, I enjoyed on one of my characters, one game we played, my character's bio described him listening to a Beatles song, and the lyrics were, some of us live in a green submarine, and the character, it was a child, and the character was like, ugh, he's messing with the music again.
Yeah.
In the timeline. I think you were the son of a time traveler in that case. You know, and I'm curious now if the character's father is another character in the game.
Yeah. There's also some good jokes with form, or like with preset form. So, for example, the Tomorrow's newspaper, every artifact has the date it's recovered from. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the like dinosaurs are from however many BC, you know, so and forth, so forth. But Tomorrow's newspaper is literally just recovered from tomorrow. It says the word tomorrow on it. It doesn't have a date, which
although,
is just like,
you know, I guess I would house rule is that not being playable in World War III, because
that's what I'm saying, because right now it is 2021.
Yeah, maybe if this game was published in 1944, you'd be able to play it then.
Yeah, but yeah, that's an example of a joke where, like, it plays off the kind of just informative part of a lot of other cards and turns that into a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, this game definitely has some tight writing to it.
Mm-hmm. I would say tight writing indeed.
Tight writing indeed.
Not typewriting.
Not typewriting. They didn't use a typewriter to make this game, as far as I know.
So, yeah, it has clever writing. I do also really want to commend the sort of thematic use of time travel. I think, for the most part, a lot of time travel in board games is pretty hard to represent. You get things like Time Stories, where it's only sort of a time travel game, but it's more like replaying the same game over and over. And then you have things that have kind of more convoluted timeline-based effects. What was that, like, worker placement game where you could borrow resources from the future?
Was that Anachrony or something like that? Or
I think
am I thinking
so,
of a different
maybe.
Game? Okay.
But I think the way this does it is one that is intentionally messy from a thematic standpoint to make it more approachable from a mechanical standpoint, which is just, you can create time paradoxes, and with only a few of them, nothing bad happens. But eventually, if there's too many paradoxes, something bad happens.
Yeah, it's nice that this game doesn't really take it too seriously. It's just like, oh yeah, you just flip a card over and there's a paradox and whatever, you can fix it later. Which it kind of adds to the humor of this game. Like, there's a paradoxes, you'd think that in most time travel stories, a paradox is like the end of all existence. But in this game, it's just like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll fix it later. Unless there's 13 of them.
Yeah. This game has a very, like, lighthearted or kind of lazy approach to time travel, whereas usually it's very serious and, like, you know, you can't upset the time stream. Kind of all the characters or the identities are kind of like, they accidentally mess with the time stream in a way. Like, there's a guy who accidentally sells a time machine to some random hippie. or there's the guy who accidentally turned the greatest time machine repairman into, like, a baseball player. Stuff like that. But like, yeah, it ends up being a little more approachable because, like, you don't really have to do as much bookkeeping. The linchpins show what cards they affect on them, and every card that, every timeline event that's affected by a linchpin has the linchpin's number, so they all kind of reference each other. If you need to look at something, you can see pretty quickly what affects it and how to do so. And the back of every card shows the like point in time that it's at, and I believe it also shows what linchpin flipped it over.
Yeah, on the events that become paradoxes, on the back they have this very fun like time spiral illustration. But it says in the center the year that the card is or takes place in, and then it has the a little pictogram. They have every linchpin has a pictogram associated with it, by the way, and then that pictogram will also appear on the timeline events that linchpin affects.
I love me some good pictograms.
And the pictograms are decent, I'll give them that, and in some cases pretty clever. Like the Waco compound burns to the ground, it's a W made to look like flames.
I love the Manhattan Project one, which is an omega with a line through it that makes it look like a mushroom cloud.
Yeah. Some of them are pretty clever. Some of them not as clever, but still decent. And they're all unique enough to differentiate from the other pictograms and make it pretty easy to figure out what happens when a certain linchpin is flipped, which I think is probably the most complicated aspect of this game, is like when this game is being designed, like how do you handle that? Like you have this timeline of cards and things flip all the time when things happen, and I think it all ended up being pretty digestible.
Yeah, I will say though, I get why the World War II or the ending of World War II timeline event is so complicated.
You mean World War III?
Well, okay, it's the one that World War III gets put on.
Okay,
I get why that's such like a complicated card, but it was kind of stressful to deal with because like I had a patch that could be played over it. And so every turn I had to like triple check all the linchpin events to make sure those were right. After I played the patch, you have to triple check that every linchpin's still in the correct position. It's because like the original timeline event can only be flipped under very specific conditions, but then also like it's like it can flip with any of the preceding three getting flipped over. So there's
three ores?
It's three ores to flip it into the paradox side, but then every patch has specific conditions for the three preceding timeline of linchpins.
Right.
And so, like, it's kind of annoying to have to keep checking, like, okay, is this one flipped there? Is this one flipped to here? Is this one flipped to here? Just because you played a patch on a previous turn.
Mm-hmm.
Some, like, extra bookkeeping. And again, I understand that, like, it's an important event, and thus it kind of is given more weight. But the bookkeeping is just kind of annoying.
Sure. I appreciate the uniqueness and how it stands out and how it, like the most unique thing is what leads to the most unique outcome of the timeline.
Which that is true.
Yeah, which is cool. I like that it's not just like every timeline event just kind of functions exactly the same. And, you know, just that little extra spice, even if it very rarely occurs, the fact that it could sometimes occur makes me more interested to play this game, at least until I experience it. Because I don't think I've actually played a game where maybe once I played a game where the World War III scenario actually happened. But only once.
I think it's interesting that this is like an alternate history themed game, because like sure it's time travel based, but I feel like most of the aesthetics present on the like table, as it were, is like an idea of like what if this happened instead of this historical event, which I feel like wide sweeping alt histories aren't really a thing in most board games. Like most things based around history tend to either be very specifically based on real history or so detached from real history that like they're only using the same names as things.
Mm-hmm.
Like a civilization type game that uses the framing of like political systems in real life isn't the same as what if those political systems played out differently, you know?
Sure.
And I'm just kind of surprised it's not as common of a theme in board games.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of fun to role play in this way, or like use it as a prompt. Be like, oh yeah, what if the Titanic didn't sink? It would cause a paradox, I guess. But I think it's a cool like prompt.
Sure,
it does a good job at making it more more investing than Flux, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to pick off the comparison.
Oh, I did section. Actually have one like kind of anecdote I wanted to say.
Would have been so good. Okay, but okay. Go ahead.
Okay, the one anecdote is that when we played this last, two other people had artifacts I needed for my mission, and that was kind of upsetting. But then I drew two cards, and I was like, okay, if I play this, I can get that artifact. If I play this, I can get another artifact. And then my hand got passed. And so I had like five or six cards in my hand. So I was like, well, I can't win that way. I no longer have the means to get the artifacts I need. And I don't have any of the patches or the inverters that I need to complete my identity. Can I just quit? Like, I feel like it was such like a more feels bad event than I was really expecting.
Woof.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. It's not that I don't like it when random things happen that impact you. It mm-hmm. was just like, I was on such a high of like, I can actually win this. I have the cards I need. And then just like mm-hmm. completely ruining it from there.
Yeah, that definitely stems from the hand passing as a mechanic is a pretty feels bad mechanic when like this game is all about like assembling very specific cards from a deck. Like, it would be one thing if it was easy It'd be one thing if it was easy to, like, reassemble your hand, but it's not in this game. You draw one, you play one. Playing one, you're really not changing much. So, yeah, it's hard to come back from that.
I think I would rather be put into a situation where another player suddenly wins than be put into one where I have no chance of winning from that point forward.
Yeah.
Because in one of them, you can just start a new game and everyone's happy. Mm-hmm. Or not everyone's happy, but you can go again. On the other one, you have to kind of wait while somebody else wins.
Sure. I will say this game, it has more setup than Flux. So, you know, going next takes a little more time. But because most of the cards go in the same deck, it doesn't take that long to reset the timeline. The first time setup takes the most just because you're putting the array of timeline cards out. But once they're in place, they don't move at all. During the game, so it's easy to reset everything back to the starting position for games two and so on.
Yeah.
All right. So that is a less good segue, but we shall segue nonetheless into our discussion on the comparison between the two games. So, yeah. So the first point that you made, I totally agree with, and that is that, like, the theming of this game is much more, like, it's much more rich and intriguing, and I'm much more interested to play this game a second time just based on its theme. I think, as far as gameplay goes, like, the gameplay doesn't necessarily excite me much more than the Flux gameplay, but yeah, the theming is very good. The writing on this game is pretty good. Yeah, and that overall excites me to play the game more.
Yeah, I think for me, it's like Flux, other than the fact that Flux is like too abstract for its own good, I think I just don't, like, as fast as Flux is, I don't really enjoy the way that the game only operates on, like, drawing cards and playing cards, like, it almost has too few verbs for its own good. Which yeah. is, it's fine if you need something really approachable, but, like, I think the additional gameplay verbs that are in Chrononauts make it more interesting to me.
Yeah, such as, like, reversing fate, patching the timeline, causing paradoxes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just drawing cards and playing cards.
Mm-hmm. Although it is still a draw one, play one game.
Yeah, but the way those cards play when you play them are a little more variable.
Yeah.
They're more diverse.
I agree.
But speaking of diversity, it is kind of awkward, the timeline, the specific events they chose.
Yeah. Now, you said this game was published in 2000.
2000.
Just 2000. Okay, yeah.
Which is why there's no 9/11.
Sure. Although they did, I believe, they did release an expansion that included 9/11.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, this game is, like, both, like, very centered on, like, the American timeline, like, relevant events related to America, also Eurocentric, and especially, like, the artifacts that you find, like Mona Lisa, Beatles albums, Shakespeare's last play. You know,
yeah,
those sorts of things. Yeah, there's not a lot of things from places that aren't America or Europe in this game. And so it's like very centered on this like experience, but it's also sort of irreverent to it because like I said, the Oklahoma City bombing and Columbine High School massacre are like timeline events. And it's kind of a silly thing when one of these timeline events switches over to a paradox, like we said. Like they kind of are pretty light about it in the sort of theming. Like if 13 happened, that's a bad thing. But if 1 or 2 happen, it's whatever. Like it'll fix.
It's actually beneficial for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
If a few happen.
So, yeah, it's kind of the tone of this game can get a little, I guess I want to say problematic. Maybe not exactly, but
definitely
yeah,
a little it's weird.
A little maybe weird. A little it makes sus. You, it can make you feel a little weird.
Yeah.
The theme of this game.
Yeah. It definitely is also like I'm more distanced from the past events, so I feel less weird about them. But when it comes to, like, Columbine, I'm like, still feels too soon.
Yeah, could we have picked a different event from 1999? And does John Lennon surviving his murder actually turn that into a paradox?
Does that actually lead to a Beatles reunion album?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, this game makes a couple interesting assumptions that can also be a little weird.
The Great Depression is the result of 2 cruise ships sinking. Mm-hmm. Or a cruise ship and a battleship.
So, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, the Lusitania and the Titanic.
Yeah.
Apparently, if both of them sink, the Great Depression, or if both of them don't sink, then the Great Depression doesn't happen.
I do think one interesting thing is that the U.S. involvement in World War II is only if 3 specific things happen. And I think that is actually kind of skating almost, like the U.S. only cared because these 3 things happened, not because mm-hmm. one of the 3 things happened.
Although actually Manhattan Project is one of those things, so they're technically right. Involved.
So I guess they're all, yeah, never mind then.
Yeah, I think it's just, well, actually, I think the main linchpin I think it's just Hitler being opening the Olympics.
Yeah,
is the true. Linchpin. I believe this is the linchpin for all of the World War II related things because the reverse side is Hitler being assassinated.
True. Okay.
So yeah. Although that's a weird, like the front side is interesting that's the linchpin.
It's a weirdly like friendly way to put it.
Yeah.
It couldn't have just been like, you know, I guess they didn't want to depict something super duper graphic and relevant to existing, groups of people.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, parts of this game make me feel weird.
Yeah.
But taken as a whole, like from a step back, if I had to just give an opinion of the tone as a whole, I think I enjoy it more than I don't enjoy it.
Yeah, the weird like ethical and like philosophical questions don't really come up during the game.
Mm-hmm.
During the game, the things that come up are I need one more picture of famous person to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess maybe this game Maybe Columbine still just needs a little more distance. I mean, this game came out in 2000 and Columbine happened in 99. So it was potentially a little too soon. But board games at the time were still a little like kind of alternative, you know, unheard of, like lesser known things. That's maybe the medium to talk about it.
Maybe.
I guess one thing about the game is that, you know, in some ways they kind of have a bit of a take on things or an opinion of things, but for the most part, all of the timeline events are sort of treated with the same irreverence. You know, like it's just an event as far as this game is concerned. You know, maybe how like the Hitler card is worded is a little weird, but for the most part, it's just like it's an event, and when something changes, it becomes a paradox. Or it's an event that has sort of a binary outcome, so the reverse side is just the other outcome. And yeah, the patches are just, I think the patches are also just meant to like rationalize the rest of the timeline. And there's really only one patch per paradox. So it's sort of like, for one example of how they're like set up. The Titanic, if it avoids disaster, then the 1929 paradox doesn't happen, or the 1929 event doesn't happen. I can't remember what event that is, but the patch for it is that the Titanic is exploded in World War One. So it's sort of like the Titanic avoids the iceberg in 1912, but in 1929, it's destroyed anyways. And that's the patch. So it's not like, you know, the paradox patches are also some sort of like commentary. It's just like redoing what's been undone.
Yeah. For the most part, everything is just the opposite of something that exists. It's not mm-hmm. like the opposite and then some further extrapolation.
Sure.
The only thing that really comes from a further extrapolation is like the identities, but those also are very, very abstract because they come from like alternate futures.
Sure.
To where like the extrapolations aren't really tangible things that could have happened.
I think I would be interested in playing a version of this game that isn't so centered on like the like on American timeline. The American timeline, or is maybe has a little broader global like timeline, and also one that doesn't touch on too many like touchy subjects.
Yeah,
I think the or maybe like one that just like really leans into the like irreverence and the jokey nature of many of the other parts of this game, but again avoiding problematic things.
Yeah. It's definitely different playing it today. I did also want to say, I don't know how I feel about, like, everybody loses scenarios in board games.
I love them, by the way.
That's interesting.
It depends on the game. You know, obviously I don't like an everybody loses scenario on a game that takes a really long time, so it just feels like everything was wasted. But I think, like, I mean, first of all, just a little quick story. Like, both of, so Cthulhu Flux, Chrononauts, and also, we didn't playtest this at all, are a handful of the games that a friend of mine in college owned. And he was a friend. We would play D&D together, me and him and a couple other people in our dorms. And after our D&D sessions, we'd still want to like hang out and game, but we didn't want to do anything that was long or complicated. So we would break out these like small games, such as Chrononauts. And we would play them, and this was, like, I knew I was a fan of board gaming, but I wasn't very familiar with these, like, smaller, like, micro games that only have a couple pieces and take little to no time to set up and are over very quickly, too. Like, they're very short games. Like, until then, I was just familiar with, like, Catan and Agricola, which take a while to set up and a while to finish. So I was introduced to this concept pretty early in my experience with board games, that like everybody loses, because it's a component in all three of the games that I listed, and it like tickled me. It was like, oh, this is cool. Like, I've never seen a game much like, not even just a board game, like I haven't really seen like a video game or anything that has this as one of the outcomes, and I enjoy it. It's kind of democratic, like it's kind of socialist. Yeah. Like everybody loses,
so
like there's no way to feel, nobody should really feel bad because everybody is experiencing the same outcome. But like, in addition, I don't know, it's like this new dimension that I hadn't really ever considered on like how games can resolve.
Yeah.
And it helps a lot that these games are very quick to play, very quick to set up. So it doesn't feel like you wasted, you know, anything when everybody loses.
I think something that's funny is that winning and losing a game is more of a mindset thing than a mechanical thing, just in the mm-hmm. sense that you can make it your own objective in these games to make everybody lose and still sure. have as many decisions as somebody wanting to win.
Yeah.
And like, if you aren't winning and you think the only way, like, if you think there's no way you can win, you can try to sabotage the game. But I think if you go into that treating that as a thing you can do, then that becomes your objective. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah,
I think I'm more okay with now that I view it as an alternative to winning that somebody mm-hmm. chooses to do.
I do want to say real quick that it helps that it's part of the game. Like, the game... Yeah. wrote in the rule book this fact. It's not like in a different game, by just playing a certain way everybody loses just like as a result, like not like, I guess I want to use conniving cooks, for example, but but we can't. But like a game where like it just keeps going on and on and on, like maybe you're stalling or you're sandbagging or something, like that's sort of akin to like playing so that everybody loses, but that's not necessarily a part of the game. In this in these games case, it's a very intentional mechanic added to the game.
Well, I was going to say that I think something interesting about Chrononauts is that if you play a lot of inverters, you give other people more chances to play patches, which means that it's easier for them to win with their identity, because it goes from needing four cards to play to be like two cards, just the two patches.
Right.
Maybe you still need that linchpin flipped, but that's still the same amount of cards as your mission. And so I think it's interesting that like if somebody really wanted to sabotage, they could very likely accidentally help out another player, which is kind of some interesting conflict.
Yeah, so I enjoy it as a mechanic in general. And it is pretty cool that like it gives you just one more avenue to sort of like express yourself or think about and approach the game.
Yeah, you like, can play a heel.
You can play the heel. All right. Do you have any other things to discuss with regards to Chrononaut and Flux?
I thought it was really interesting that the version of Chrononauts we have has expansion symbols on some of the cards. As in, like, they affect cards from other expansions. I assume that's because what we have is a more modern reprint. But yeah, it does make
probably
me curious.
Like a newer version.
It does make me curious what those symbols actually represent.
Sure. I think some of them were easy to guess, like 9/11.
Yeah.
Was a pretty obvious symbol. But yeah, some of them, yeah, definitely curious, like, what they could represent. And yeah, there are expansions that expand the timeline in both directions, I believe. So there's one with more current events, and either in the same expansion or maybe in a different expansion, there's one with more older, like, previous events.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool about this game. Yeah, I would definitely play this game again, given the chance. But maybe, I don't know, it could be fun to just take out the card that passes all the hands around and then just play without it. Just sort of house rule that card out of existence. Because I agree that it can lead to some situations that are just a little too feels bad, man.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So with that, that concludes our discussion on Flux and Chrononauts. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
We'll see you next episode.
Bye-bye.